Sup, freaks? It's your boy Marty Bent here to introduce this week's sponsor before we hop into the interview with Zach Prince and Renee Van Kestern from BlockFi. This week's episode of Tales from the Crypt is brought to you by 21 Lectures. 21 Lectures' mission is to bring more developers to the Bitcoin ecosystem with in-person courses. These courses are lectured by world-renowned Bitcoin and Lightning developers. Some of you freaks have definitely seen them on Twitter and in other places and GitHub repositories, more importantly. The 21 Lectures courses teach participants the fundamentals of working with the Bitcoin blockchain and technologies above it, like Lightning. They cover cryptography, the structure of transactions and blocks, and how they are chained together, smart contract languages, the Lightning protocol, as well as software and toolkits to develop on top of Bitcoin and Lightning in particular. To learn more, visit 21lectures.com. That's 21lectures.com. You freaks know I'm all about education and spreading the good word about Bitcoin. More importantly, making more people aware of what it is and how to interact with it pertinently, developers. Disclaimer before we hop into this episode, obviously, BlockFi has been a sponsor of this podcast in the past. Zach reached out to me personally, wanted to catch up and chat. We hadn't chat since last July, and also jump into the recent product that BlockFi released, the interest-bearing account that got some blowback on Twitter. So we sort of sat down and walked through the product and how they're looking at it and the risk involved with interacting with it, the privacy stuff, all the stuff that you freaks want to hear. Another disclaimer, tested out a new mic with this episode in particular. So number one, sorry that if Renee and Zach seem a little distant, I thought this mic was going to pick up their sound a little bit better. Number two, it picked up a little bit of music. Wasn't expecting that either. And then number three, it's a bit of an awkward introduction because I'm sort of monitoring the new mic as I'm introing Zach and Renee, which produced a bit of an awkward intro. But the flow of the conversation gets better as we get into more IPAs and cider. Hope you freaks enjoy it. I know I did.
From the Crypt. What is up, freaks? Welcome back to Tales from the Crypt. It's your boy Marty Bent here on a Tuesday night. I'm trying to think of what night it is. A Tuesday night in March in the studio. Wife's at a show, so I got the studio apartment as the podcast studio for the night. Very excited for tonight's conversation. Sitting down with two guests, one of which you freaks know already, Zach Prince from BlockFi. Zach, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. And, seems like the podcast business is going well. Your place is very nice.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's you get to write all this off with being a podcaster. The government pays for it. I'm kidding. And we've also got Renee. Your last name Van Kestern.
Van Kestern, close enough.
Van Kestern, yeah. BlockFi's chief risk officer.
Yeah.
And before we get into everything, it's been a fun week for you guys. Before we get into BlockFi specific stuff. Renee, this is Tales from the Crypt. We usually hear people's tale, how they got the Bitcoin, how they got where they are in the industry, your path. We have not heard your tale. How the hell did you get here?
So I started seriously started in the summer of 2017, although I heard about Bitcoin way before that. But dismissed it as nerd money. I actually had some people working for me that wanted to open up a Coinbase account, and I told them they were not allowed to do that because compliance would give a problem. I was at a bank at the time. So I got involved in 2017, and quickly after that met Zach and got more involved in Bitcoin. I've been a firm believer ever since. I'm still amazed about what the technology can do, and in my mind, it's already the killer app, is the distributed ledger system and that we have right now in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, so how's you been in the industry per se, advising for the last year and a half, 2 years, you'd say?
So I started an advisor in pretty early on, sort of in September 2017, when the company just started, and joined full-time in May 2018, yeah. So almost there a year now.
So how's this industry compared to the industries of your prior life?
Oh my goodness, where shall I start? Yeah. although
what were you doing before?
Yeah, before that, I was at Bank of America Merrill Lynch, legacy Merrill Lynch, in the prime brokerage area, AML Pro. I was a managing director, run a business where we made loans. So everything that fell actually outside of PB, the traditional margin lending, stock loan, and swaps, that would come to me. And you know, they would come to me because it didn't clear and settle through DTC the regular way. So you had to do other things like say a seat on exchange or physical gold or certificates, or it fell outside of the risk parameters. You know, someone that had 20% of a company. That they want to finance the stock, that or normally our risk system would kick that out.
Yeah. Like middle market stuff.
No, you should think about this could be big owners of ExxonMobil stock, or the guy that owns Oracle, Ellison, those kind of things. You know.
Sweet.
Yeah. Can I ask Renee a question? What were you doing before that, and how much money did you lose in the financial crisis?
Which one are we talking?
Which financial crisis?
Oh,
2009. All right, so 2008, 2009, we did not lose money in the business that we had then. It's very collateralized lending, so in general, you should be fine. The biggest risk that you have is mostly around mismatching maturities, right? So you make commitments to other people for a year and your financing is much shorter dated, but we did not have much of that. We had everything done in the right place.
Yeah. And you were doing some like prop trading at Caxton before your
15. Before that, I was prop trading at Caxton. So,
so you see some shit?
Yeah. So you see some shit? It's still on the go, actually, so I don't want to talk about it anymore. I was not very successful prop trading, to be honest. So.
Yeah. What's been the biggest difference getting into the Bitcoin world? How are these markets compared to the ones you're coming from?
24/7, right? It's constantly open, right? And there are a couple of differences. Like one thing, people talk about the Bitcoin price, but such a thing doesn't really exist, right? Ooh. Bitcoin has many prices at the same time at many different places. Bitcoin is the same thing in Beijing as it is in New York, right? Whereas IBM stock is different in the US than it is overseas, right? Because in China, it will be actually still sitting in the U.S. and the U.S. government can still take it. Mm-hmm. You don't have a Bitcoin 24/7, as I said. Sort of the main things.
Settlement's pretty cool.
Settlement, yeah, there's no settlement, right? That's actually very interesting too. So, I think in traditional markets, you have these couple of layers, as you know. You got sort of the central clearing houses like DTC. And then you have broker dealers on top of it or banks that are members of DTC. And then you are a customer of the bank or of the broker-dealer, and they keep track of it. In general, there's this whole clearing cycle, so when you actually buy or sell IBM stock, you don't get it at that moment. You'll get it, it's T+2 now, so I get 2 days later. Mm-hmm. Right? In Bitcoin, obviously, the selling cycle is much shorter. It's 10 minutes per block, so you want to wait a couple of confirmations, so I guess it's like 20 minutes to an hour.
Yeah, it depends on your confirmation limit that you want to hit, your threshold, I guess.
That's right. You can also wait if you want to wait longer. More certain, right? You can wait a day if you like.
Right? Yeah. No, it's fascinating. And
There's another big benefit, too, since for interrupting, but since we're at the settlement, too. If you look at regular markets, you have everybody has their own record of where things are, right? So you have constant reconciliation that goes on over those two business days between multiple parties, right? So you had an account at Deutsche Bank and you sold it to someone that had an account at Morgan Stanley, and they need to sort of like, oh yeah, I see it and I can see it too, and then they need to go to DTC and they have like their own reconciliation going on. Whereas in Bitcoin, obviously, you don't have that. There's one ledger, we're all looking at the mm-hmm. same movie the whole time. Zach, no, I yelled many times for it.
Yeah, we get in trouble sometimes with product ideas where someone will say something about making the user experience from somebody who's borrowing or depositing or something a certain way, and Renee's like, screw that, just tell them to look at the blockchain. Tell them to look at the blockchain. Is it there? If it's there, you got it. Like, it's done.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's cool, right? No?
Yeah. No, and it like, with the DTC...
I mean, I can open up the browser too for you, but why would you ask me? Just look yourself. Right? Is that like the whole point, that you can see it yourself?
Well, this goes into like a whole other conversation, a theme of this podcast in particular, which is the UX around the experiences of people interacting with companies like BlockFi or exchanges like Gemini or Block Explorers, like blockchain.info or blockstream.info. I would recommend blockstream.info because it's a lot better, in my opinion. But the UX around it, like, you can have new experiences, like things like proof of reserves, you can prove on the blockchain with signatures and stuff like that, and now settlement as well. So it's a new like mindset for people, like, oh, I can actually verify this, where I can't, they're not going to go verify it on Swift or within the banking network. They just see it in their banking account.
Yeah.
They're checking it out.
It's just bookkeeping by one person.
Yeah.
And you hope they got it right. And in general, they got it right. But,
yeah.
You know, the auditing is just built in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you got to keep your own records too.
Yeah. I don't want to jump right into rehypothecation, but, that's like, this is like naturally where it's going. But we'll wait. Fascinating story. Fascinating tale, Renee.
Yeah.
Zach, let's catch up now. It's been like 7 months.
I know, it's been a while.
You were telling me the price when we had our conversation was $7,000.
We were looking on the way over here.
Yeah.
And I was like, when was the last time I was here? But, you know, even more importantly, to touch on your rehypothecation point, I was thinking on Sunday, you know, we had an announcement last week. There's been a lot of attention given to the announcement, a lot of questions.
A lot of Twitter hoopla.
And, I was like, all right, how are we going to respond to this? Like, one, next time we launch a product that's as big of a attention getter as this, we will be sure to learn from the amount of information we put out this time relative to the amount of information we'll put out next time about what's going on behind the scenes. But two, like, okay, here we are. Where are we going to talk about it? And I was like, Tales from the Crypt was my first podcast. I want to bring Renee. He hasn't done a podcast before. He loves beer. Marty loves drinking. And we just had to come here first, man. So we're pumped to be here again. I'm happy to see you. Based on your apartment, I would say that you've done okay in the bear market. We found a way to keep growing throughout the bear market. You know, since we were last here, we raised some more money from some great investors, including Fidelity. Continued to grow the team. We've continued to build products, including the one that we launched last week. So it's you know, I'm feeling really bullish. I've been saying to people that the price is going to be higher at the end of this year than it was at the beginning of this year, and what that's going to do is attract attention.
Yeah,
and then new people are going to come in 2020, and then we've got all the happening stuff too, and so. If you're still alive, still growing, still doing well, it's a phenomenal time to be in this market.
Yeah. Well, first off, freaks, if you can't feel it already, I'm blushing. If you can't feel it through your butts, thank you for the kind words. I really appreciate you thinking of us in particular. Now, secondly, you're looking great. Considering the prices halved and then risen a little bit, you would think you would look haggard and out of shape, but you're looking svelte.
Luckily, we built our risk management system. So.
And then, yeah, I guess, like, yeah, let's drop it. So for any of you freaks who are not on Twitter and are not involved in the crazy chaos that is Bitcoin Twitter, obviously BlockFi just released an interest-bearing account that any Bitcoin or Ether holder can send to gain interest on that up to 6.2%, correct?
Yeah, so the interest rate in the account right now is 6% a year. It's paid out monthly in crypto. And after interest is paid out, it earns interest because it's part of your balance. That's called compounding interest. So the yield in the account is 6.2% annually.
Yeah. All right. So let's break down. So you guys basically released your terms of service where you said basically anything, like everything that is possible when you're engaging with a Bitcoin third-party custody service, which is it is possible with this technology that stuff can get stolen, has gotten stolen in the past, and you're just letting people know this has happened, this is a risk. This is a risk, I would argue, for any Bitcoin exchange or platform out there, number one. And number two, having been in the fund space and been on a due diligence team, to me, that just looked like clauses that were abundance of caution, just trying to be as transparent as possible. But then on top of that, people have worries about who's lending, who's taking out the loans on the other side, where they're doing it with it, and how's that going to affect the Bitcoin held on the accounts. Most importantly, is it short sellers, and with Bitcoin's volatile price in the past, how's your guys' risk management system set up for that? So let's just dive into it.
Yes. Yeah, so,
is that good?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, and we can take this down a few different paths, but how about I address what I think were kind of the two biggest things that came up is feedback on the terms and conditions, touch a little bit on rehypothecation, and then we can go into some of the more risk management type things and understand like how we're handling that and what our system is and how it works.
Yeah.
So I think the two biggest things that we heard about the T's and C's were two sections. One section that basically said BlockFi is not liable for any damages you may incur in the event that we have to suspend withdrawals. So it's all this stuff like something might happen and you might not be able to withdraw your crypto. And where that came from is that, one, abundance of caution. And in general, our terms of service were written with an abundance of caution type approach. We're doing something that doesn't fall into a particularly clear regulatory construct today. So when you work with your legal teams to build things like this, they just say you have to be really careful. Mm-hmm. And if you read a stock prospectus for an IPO, if you read the whole thing, you're going to think you shouldn't buy the stock because every single risk is going to be spelled out. It's going to sound like a horrible business, and you're going to be like, why am I even participating in this market? So that's the bucket that we fell into in terms of our legal representation. But on that section about withdrawal disruptions, the reason we had to do that is because BlockFi is not actually custodying the crypto or holding the private keys. We decided early on that that was not something that was kind of our role to play in the market, given what we wanted to do was build debt and credit type financial products. So we partnered with Gemini. And so basically the legal team is like, well, what happens if Gemini suspends withdrawals for a while? And we're like, well, then we can't withdraw anything. And they're like, okay, you know. Mm-hmm. And on the second thing, the rehypothecation section, what I'm hoping to do today and also through more dialogue in the future and some articles that we're going to put out is explain why I think it's important for us to make rehypothecation not like a boogeyman word. Understand.
Big boogeyman word.
It's a huge boogeyman word. I mean, if you don't know what it means, or even if you do, if you like say it, you're like, oh God, that sounds scary. Like, I just don't want you to do it. Let's not do that. Let's not do that at all. But here's what rehypothecation means. It just means that an asset from somebody else that was posted as security or is owed back to them and put in a new place gets relent out. It's basically the core value proposition of being able to earn interest on your Bitcoin through someone like BlockFi is, okay, I'm going to put my Bitcoin with you, you're going to lend it out, there's going to be a return generated, and I get to make that money. That's how it works. Mm-hmm. The two things that are value add from rehypothecation are, one, in traditional markets, rehypothecation has been a huge downward cost driver for access to products. So the reason that you can trade for free, the reason that fees on ETFs and other asset management vehicles, the reason that custody, all of those things are like either free or close to free in traditional markets is because of tools like rehypothecation. The other thing is, on the short selling point, if you listen or read what the SEC says when they're declining Bitcoin ETFs, they frequently come to this topic of fair and orderly markets. And the function of being able to borrow an asset and express multiple different views in terms of where you think an asset will move is a core function to having a fair and orderly market. And so the type of lending that we do helps to facilitate that. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a separate question of how do you manage the risk and how risky is that? And obviously, we're very thoughtful about that and we should talk about it. But those two things I think people should remember. And then as like a thematic overhang, I believe that what we're trying to do is compete with the traditional system, whether that's the traditional financial system or the traditional fiat system. And the reality is those guys have a bunch of really badass tools that they've built over a long time that work really, really well. Capitalism is insanely powerful. Like, there isn't some technological thing other than the blockchain. That's like the one exception that that the financial system hasn't figured out how to do in some way, shape, or form. They just might have done it with legal documents and financial structuring instead of technology. And if we're trying to compete with that world and we're not able to use the same tools, I don't think we have a big chance of winning. And then lastly, and we should jump into risk management or take more questions, lastly, I would just say, just because something exists in the market doesn't mean it has to be for everyone. The cool thing about Bitcoin is that that stuff could go on and you could choose to just opt out of it.
Yeah.
Not everybody has to use things. You want a diversity of options.
I'm not even relieved. I'm just like, why is everybody freaking the fuck out? Like, you don't have to use it if you don't want to. But people are worried, I guess. So, like, rehypothecation, why it's a boogeyman word is because people assume that there's notionally more Bitcoin than anybody could possibly have claim to.
So that's not necessarily the case, right? So if you think about the supply of Bitcoin is pretty given. Actually, we know that right today what it is, right? I think it's 80 million something, whatever, right? It will not be more. It will approximate 21 million by formula unless somebody changes the protocol, which doesn't seem very likely, right? So if you actually lend out the Bitcoin the way we do it because of where we are, we would lend it out via the blockchain. So it will be recorded on the blockchain. So we have to have the Bitcoin. We cannot lend out Bitcoins we don't have.
Yes.
So that's not happening with us, right? If you think about some of the exchanges that do offer sort of this leverage trading and shorting at 100x, right? There, obviously, they work a lot more like the rehypothecation will work in a broker-dealer land, right? So like what Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch can do, or Schwab can do for you, right? So they will have 1,000, they have customers that are combined long 1,000 shares of Apple. They got a bunch of customers on the other side that are short 500 shares of Apple. Net, they have 500 shares of Apple needed, right? Because they just internalize the short versus the longs. And that 500 sits at DTC. So they only record 500 shares of DTC. Then with that combined with the settlement cycle of T+2 and all the things that go wrong, all the reconciliation that happens, you miscount things, right? And many people use many examples that happens. But it even happens around dividends as well, right? That's not what we're doing, right? And even that is okay, as long as you're aware of it, right? As long as you know, hey, that's happening, and that's why I get the leverage, right? So the guy that has the 1,000 shares of Apple now only needs to put up, 10% or 20% of the value of his Apple shares, because the broker dealer can turn around to lend it out, make money that way, etc. Right?
Yeah. How much of Bitcoin being a bearer asset comes into play here? Like how big in changing sort of the structure of these debt markets, if at all? I don't know.
Sorry, I didn't get the question.
Bearer asset meaning like you
can hold it.
Hold it yourself, right? Like I can't.
So Bitcoin is a bearer asset, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can do indices around it, right? So I mean, you can reference the value of Bitcoin as a trade somewhere, but actually owning Bitcoin, that is a bearer asset. That has to go. You can have somebody else can hold it on your behalf, right? By opening up an account at many of these places, but the beauty of Bitcoin is, unlike securities or money, you can actually hold it yourself.
Yeah. Right?
You can transfer it to your own private key.
Yeah, no, and it's, I mean,
I failed miserably at that once and twice. to somebody else. You go download that Ethereum wallet. That's not easy, man.
You tried it, yeah.
I tried it. I tried to set up an Ethereum, I couldn't. Bitcoin worked. Electrum wallet, I got that done in a couple of hours, but.
Ethereum.
Ethereum, it's like, I couldn't get it done. This didn't sync with nodes or something, it said.
Yeah, that's a big problem they're having. We're not sure what a full node is or what it's okay there. Apparently, there's only one to three full nodes in the world. Block Cipher let us know earlier this week. But I guess what I was trying to get at is gold and using gold as collateral, but people rarely call the physical gold and take possession.
Yeah, that's actually good. So there was a couple of years ago, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, that there was this, oh my God, this is actually enough gold in the world, right? But first of all, that's even a very interesting topic, right? Because we even don't know how much gold there is in the world. We actually don't even know how much gold is above ground. We actually don't even know how much gold is in Fort Knox.
Right.
Right? Whereas in Bitcoin, we know all these things. So at least one side of Bitcoin we know very well, right? Now, you can still have all these other claims, and people say, oh, you know, well, if I'm going to ask him to give me my gold back, he's going to ask, you know, he's going to ask that guy, and then I have the guy, my gold over there, and mine will be there, so let's not do this, right? I got that. But that's, that with Bitcoin is not really possible, because they actually know exactly how much gold, how much Bitcoin there is.
Yeah.
So, you know, could you design claims on Bitcoin? Yeah, you can always reference the price. And actually, that's happening today. CME, you know, trades $100 million of futures a day.
No Bitcoin.
Right. They have no Bitcoin at CME whatsoever, right? Yeah. I mean, it's just referencing the price. They find the buyer and the seller.
No, it's like, no, it's just fascinating watching these markets develop and sort of the fear. Like, people are like, I think people just have an existential fear of repeating the mistakes that led us to 08 and shit like that. So I guess let's drop into risk management. So how are you managing the margin risk in particular, especially if short sellers are lending this on the other side and Bitcoin's volatile price history?
Well, you can, there are sort of two main ways of managing it, right? So one, you can do it like you do with equities or securities in general, right? Where you just get collateral. So you said, hey, I'll give you a value of $1 million. You're going to give me $1.2 million back in dollars, say, right? And then you monitor that. And, you know, with Bitcoin, the interesting part is that you can monitor 24/7, and you can even make margin calls 24/7 because they can send it right back, right, if there's a problem. And that's sort of what we do in some part of it. The other part is more you act like a bank. So you say, hey, I got people depositing money with me. I'm making loans. And I then now need to manage the credit risk to the other side. So you do the credit due diligence on the borrowers of the Bitcoin, right? As if it's like borrowing yen or euros, right? Mm-hmm. And you diversify, right? And then you have capital against that in case one of them doesn't work out. Right?
Yeah.
But in general, diversification is probably the biggest tool you have.
And how's that diversification work as you guys scale up and your book gets bigger?
Finding a lot of counterparties, yeah.
Yeah.
It gets stronger. The bigger, yeah. There's benefits to scale.
Yeah.
So when you're doing the lending over collateralized, that's pretty easy. Even with the price gapping up, because that's just, you just model and look at the data and you say, okay, I want to be okay in 99.9% of the scenarios, and like if a 0.01 happens, then a 0.01 happens, and you figure it out then. But that part's pretty easy, and that's, by the way, that's the same system that we've used since January of 2018 on the USD loan side of things, except now instead of needing to take those actions when Bitcoin prices go down, we also need to take those actions when Bitcoin prices go up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's modeling the same way. You're modeling volatility, you're modeling volatility over time, and then you're modeling liquidity access. The other part, the counterparty credit risk part, to understand how we think about that, I think it's helpful to understand how we've kind of like segmented that market. So right now we think of it as having five kind of distinct segments. The first segment is CME and CBO futures. These are ranked by kind of, as a general rule, credit quality of the counterparties in the segment. So number one is like CME and CBO. I mean, that's, they're like less risky than the U.S. government.
They default, we're fucked.
Well, I mean, yeah, like if you have defaulted,
so much for decentralization.
Yeah, like if those things go down, we got bigger problems.
Mm-hmm. This is actually, by the way, interesting, right? So if you look at the, sorry for interrupting,
no worries.
If you look at the U.S. government, right, or actually bank regulations, they all force you to go to a central counterparty, which is completely antithetical to the Bitcoin concept.
Right? Mm-hmm.
It's about, you know, much more being diffuse and zenish and have a very small attack service instead of here. Like, you know, you have to go after one guy,
right?
The CME and the CBOE, and you can stop a lot of the U.S. financial systems in.
Well, somebody pulls it down, you know?
Yeah. Rabbit hole.
Anyway, sorry.
It's okay. We like that here.
We can go down.
Okay. Yeah. No, but it's fascinating. Especially with like the price movements and all. So I guess what we should jump into is how, like, one thing I'm fascinated is you guys are sort of getting your bearings in a bear market, I would say. Like, and how's that been? How have your risk models sort of reacted to the price reaction over the last, gone down 50% and then up a little bit since we last met?
We were too conservative, that's what we concluded.
Yeah?
that was one of the conclusions we had, at a higher level, I mean, the risk system worked perfectly. Mm-hmm. Our portfolio never even came close to losing a penny on the USD loan side in terms of being upside down with how much collateral we had relative to the lending balance. And so that, that performed as expected, worked as designed, no issues whatsoever. Other than something that I think is interesting to mention, because it brings up a point that I think is important around just code versus around valuing a client relationship. So one of the times that our risk management system was firing on all cylinders was like, it was like Thanksgiving night at 10 p.m. or something. the market was going down aggressively, and our risk management system was working, which meant that we were selling Bitcoin. The next day, of course, we wake up and some of our clients are like, guys, I have more. I didn't want to sell. I could have given it to you, but, I was passed out from eating too much turkey. And, and our response was basically, no problem. Let's just send more. We'll unwind the trade. And it's all good. And we're able to do that because we have rules, but we get to choose whether we implement them rigidly or not.
You're bringing a personalization to this.
By the way, it was not unwinding too. It was actually we did an opposite trade.
So you just
can't undo the trade, right?
So you
correct.
Just,
yeah, sorry. Yeah. It's just technicality.
Yeah, you sort of even or negged it out, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's another thing. So how
we just bought the Bitcoin back didn't charge people for any of that. We're like, okay, cool.
All right, and so,
we can just do that. We'll do that right now for you. Thank you for being a client.
What's that experience been like on the customer service side? How do you guys view that? Like how are your competitors doing it, and how are you guys trying to do it differently on that side?
Our business strategy is to try and get to a place like the place that the first bank you ever had might have with you. And what place is that? It's like, for me, I have 4 or 5 different accounts with Chase Bank. I have a debit card, a credit card, checking account, a savings account, and maybe some insurance or something. And I get letters in the mail all the time from Bank of America or somebody else, and it says, we'll give you $250 to open up a checking account with us. And that's free money, but I just throw it away because I'm like, that sounds miserable. What am I going to do? Like, get rid of all my accounts? Like, I just do everything there. Our business strategy is to try and do that same type of thing, have that same type of relationship with our client, where we have like 3, 4, 5 things that we offer that they like and use, and therefore we're able to have stickiness. Mm. And stickiness, having stickiness with your clients is something that's incredibly important in financial services. If you listen to the first podcast, you know I come from like a fintech background, specifically in the lending side, where you had a lot of new companies competing to build big businesses. And one of the things I learned was, if you can generate client satisfaction and like affinity to your brand or just happiness with your service, then you can win a little bit in financial services, which are hyper-commoditized. Like, generally, financial services, you're giving me a product, and I can price it against somebody else's, and if they're cheaper, like, I don't care about you. It's a loan. Like, what, I'm going with the cheaper one.
Right.
But if you can do things where you build enough of a relationship, you have enough of a diversified product set, you're delivering enough value, and frankly, if people, like, just kind of like you enough, then you're able to get a little bit of pricing power. So that's our strategy, and this is our second product. We'll probably have 2 more products that come out this year, and then another 1 to 3 over the following 2 years, and we're going to try and make each one of those applicable and valuable to as many of our clients as possible.
That's awesome. What have most BlockFi users been using, either the USD loans, or obviously they'll be using the interest account to get interest, but the USD loans in particular, what are most people using it for? Or do you even know?
We ask as part of the kind of loan application process, what are you going to do with the money? The only wrong answer there is if you say something illegal, which we've had some, like, a few just random hilarious responses.
What's the funniest one?
I thrown off the platform.
You know what? I can't remember the word anymore, but it was some slang word that I hadn't even heard of before that meant, like...
I'm starting a blue ice factory or something like that.
It meant, like, I'm gonna like, drug deal. Like, yeah. It was some word for, like, slanging... I'm slinging sloppy tunas. I don't know what the expression was.
Breaking Bad, for sure.
Yeah.
It was something like that. So we see a split depending on the size of the loan. So for loans under $20,000, we generally see that they're being used to pay down higher cost debt. So we make loans at rates as low as 4.5% a year now, which if you have a unsecured personal loan, certainly if you carry credit card debt and you also own crypto, it makes perfect financial sense to just take a loan from BlockFi, pay off the higher cost debt, and now you still have debt, but it's at a lower price. Above a $20,000 loan size, it's a wealth management tool. So we see people who buy houses, specifically investment properties, diversify into other traditional assets like stocks or bonds or private equity investment vehicles, all without selling their crypto, so they still keep their long Bitcoin position and they don't trigger a taxable event. And then in emerging markets, we're just kind of starting to get into emerging markets.
Oh, really? I didn't even know that. Which ones?
Well, we're focusing on LATAM on the emerging market side. We're also focusing on Japan on the mature market side. So, down there, it's this story of like, governments and corporations have been able to borrow dollars, like that's been a thing they've been able to do for a really long time. And that market hit new highs last year, crossed $11 trillion. But retail has never been able to borrow dollars. And now they can, if they own Bitcoin. And they can do it at a cheap rate. And that's really valuable. It's a really valuable utility for Bitcoin to have. So... it's just a way to keep their Bitcoin, get access to more liquidity at a low cost. I mean, if you're in Argentina, I think consumer credit rates down there, it's like 50% because the inflation in the economy is so high. The peso's crashed 3 times in 100 years. So you have this dramatic diversity of rate environments in the world. And in places where the rates are really high, Bitcoin as a vehicle to secure low-cost financing can be insanely valuable. So we're trying to do more of that. Like, we're starting to put out press releases in Spanish. We're interviewing with some of the crypto, Spanish language media sites and stuff. So we're excited about that.
That's dope. What are the different obstacles, like, with the governments and banking systems down there than you have here in the U.S.? Are they, like, welcome you with open arms? Like,
we're not touching them.
No?
We're not touching them yet. So... Okay. If we wanted to make a loan in Argentinian pesos and transfer it from an Argentinian bank to another Argentinian bank account, we would probably need to do the same thing that we did in the U.S., like understand exactly which licenses we need and have local bank accounts. But we're kind of deciding not to do that yet. And so when we fund the loan, we either fund it with an international wire or we fund it in a stable coin. And when we say stablecoin BlockFi, we mean one of the ones that has like verifiable dollars in a U.S. bank account, like GUSD or PAX or some of the others that are in that camp, not like the Tether or DAI camp.
Okay.
So we fund it either via international wire or one of those,
and they just
dollar-backed stablecoins.
Yeah, and they just eat the conversion fee, or so that they don't like. They want to hold the U.S. dollar on your platform and then use it from there. No, obviously not.
No, but we want to enable that in the future.
Yeah.
So we've been looking into options where we could, for example, create a virtual debit card that could be spent anywhere, denominated in dollars, but available to be issued to someone who's in Argentina or Brazil.
Yeah.
haven't found the answer to that one yet, but I think that would be really cool.
Yeah. No, it's crazy how... So how much has Bitcoin enabled this creativity that you have and this ability to...
Yeah, all of it.
Yeah.
I mean, neither one of our products that we have right now would work without Bitcoin.
Yeah.
The Bitcoin is the thing. I mean, it is the thing. And if Bitcoin weren't in the market and you didn't have a market leader like Bitcoin with a 60, 70, I don't know what the market cap of Bitcoin is right now, but, you know, 60, 70 billion-ish market cap, then businesses like ours couldn't exist because our addressable market would be too small. So without Bitcoin, there's no any of what we're doing.
It's great to know. Thanks, Bitcoin. Thanks for enabling all this cool shit. Back to the interest-bearing account. I think another question I forgot to ask. And so, like, the interest rate 6.2% annual potential right now. How does that fluctuate? Obviously, it's supply and demand for the book, correct? And how are you sort of coming to that inflation rate on an ongoing basis?
It's two things. It's supply and demand for the book plus our customer acquisition cost budget for this product.
Mm-hmm.
We are, you know, for better or worse, the business strategy and path that we're on is a venture capital funded path.
Mm-hmm.
So in the same way that it took Amazon a long time to actually become a profitable business, we're in general going down the path of, like, maybe we're not profitable until 6 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as our growth rates are really high, VCs are like, yeah, keep going. Keep it going. We'll keep buying more of your company, you know, every year when you need another round of funding, as long as you're growing. So it's the market plus a budget of our equity capital that we're comfortable spending on delivering a product that attracts new clients to our platform.
Yeah. And what do you think you need to do to hit, like, breakaway speed where you become profitable? Like, how big does your product suite need to be? How big does the liquidity pool on your book need to be?
We don't think about necessarily profitability from a single product line perspective. Mm-hmm. We think of it from a, what does it cost to acquire a customer? And then how much revenue do we generate from the multitude of things that customer may do with us, less our operating expenses of delivering that product. Which is a fancy way of saying, we have no clue right now. we're going to keep building a bunch of things, and as long as we're growing, as long as we're still growing, and, you know, the interest account was a huge success in that regard. We set what we thought was an aggressive target when we launched the beta in January. We blew past it for Q1. We blew past it mid-February. So then we, like, reset an aggressive target, and then we blew past that in the first week since the press release. So despite some of the sentiment on Twitter, the sentiment and the data in terms of, you know, sign-ups and clients and all of that has been overwhelmingly positive. So it's working really, really well. As a matter of fact, we decided to start raising our next round of capital on a slightly faster timetable than we were planning because the metrics look so good.
A whole in a bear market. What does that say?
We are bringing products to the market that weren't there before. I mean, there wasn't an account like this interest account before from a company that is legitimate. And by legitimate, I mean, doesn't have an insanely high level of counterparty risk and didn't do an ICO.
Right.
So we were, you know, if you exclude those two things, we were the first ones to do this. And it's an attractive rate. And we thought a lot about, you know, where do we set the rate? We know how much we can lend it out for to some people, but as your supply that you have to lend out goes up, the rate that you're able to charge generally goes down. So there's a little bit of finger in the air, right? Like, okay, what works at 5 million might not work at 50. What works at 50 might not work at 500.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to use, you know, data plus judgment. And, so we wanted to put something out there that we thought was attractive but also sustainable. And that's how we got to that number.
How long do you think somebody would have to keep Bitcoin or Ether in this interest-bearing account to a point where it's, yes, it's like 6.2%, but with taxes and stuff when you take it out, like how long would you recommend somebody lock up Bitcoin in this account to sort of get the best bang for their buck in the long run? Like from a...
Forever.
Right, yeah. from a time perspective.
Like
how
long do you keep dollars in a bank account?
Yeah, so like what is the target customer? Somebody's just looking to stash Bitcoin away for a couple decades, a year.
We want to be the hub where if you're okay storing your Bitcoin with a centralized party, which we know is not for everyone.
Honestly, that's like the question I have.
Which,
like,
we know is not for everyone.
Do I want to dox my UTXOs? So I'm like taking my hat. I'm like,
yeah, we know that's not for everyone. That's great. But if you are okay with that, we hope that, you know, at some point in the near future, you try it, you like it. One of the, you know, things we saw in the beta was that every time we pay interest, which is once a month at the beginning of the month, people refer their friends and, like, deposit more because they're like, this is great. This is awesome.
Get more Bitcoin.
Yeah, I'm getting more Bitcoin. So we want to be the hub, right? So, like, in the same way that you don't take dollars out of your primary bank account at some point in time, we would like to be that same account, but in a world where, in the world where you're doing things with your Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's, and going back to like the tax thing, like, is there an amount of time where it just makes sense to keep it in that? Like, is
the...
Well,
the tax thing is interesting. So,
yeah.
This will be taxed at like interest. Interest is taxed as a general rule, unless it's from like a municipal bond or something, as ordinary income. So what we do every month is we take the price that Bitcoin was at the time we paid out the interest, and then that dollar number is what will show up on your 1099 div, which we'll provide everyone a 1099. The 1099 div is like 1099 for dividends.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually, it might be, sorry, not div, INT, 1099 INT. Everybody will get one of those from tax year 2019 from BlockFi, and it'll be in dollars. But you will have never had dollars hit your account at BlockFi. It'll all have been in Bitcoin. But one of the challenges operating in the crypto world is that taxes can be just a royal pain in the ass, and so we were like, okay, if we're going to do this, we need to figure out how to not make it a royal pain in the ass from a tax perspective. So that was the USC way we decided to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like it's a tax form just like the tax form you get from an account at Betterment or, you know.
So it's USD denominated, so you don't have to worry about like conversion costs and stuff like that.
Yeah, you don't have to do all that math and backtracking and transaction figuring out yourself.
Yeah, hopefully they figure that out and just streamline it.
Well, hopefully they just put some beneficial tax rules around Bitcoin.
Right. I think, I mean...
A little clarity would be good, too, because I'm not sure if it's interest, actually. It could be just a dividend, too, since you started with that, which means zero cost basis until you do something with it.
Let's jump
into stock split or something, right?
So jump into that. So explain how dividends work opposed to interest when it comes to taxes.
And well, I actually don't know that well, so to be honest.
Well, okay, well, yeah. why do you think...
There's a concept of qualified and unqualified dividends, right? I don't remember the difference between the two, but probably you pay less taxes on one and more on the other.
Well, it's a stock dividend, right? So you start with having 10 shares, now you have 11.
Can
right?
Dividends only come from... So would it be a dividend? It would be a dividend for BlockFi and not for Bitcoin, obviously. So, yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's not a dividend. I just misspoke on the tax form.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's the INT, it's interest.
I didn't look at it at all, but, there's a lot of debate. And
that's another thing. Like, we're sort of part of this expanding universe where you don't know what you're expanding into, and sort of figuring out how people are interacting with these products, how these products are interacting with traditional markets and liquidity pools and traditional trader tendencies and mindsets and how they interact with financial products.
Bitcoin did pop 3% 1 minute after we put the press release.
Well, that was actually...
I'm taking credit.
That was actually a day after I dropped the Jack interview, so I think we can...
No, but it was like...
I'm kidding.
The news was 8 a.m., and then Bitcoin, it was like...
Boom.
It was like... Psh.
Yeah, I think that's when I dropped the pod, too. We'll figure out.
I'm kidding.
I would be happy if I could just say that we did that. I'm like, hell yeah. I started a company in the crypto space. We moved the price of Bitcoin up 3% on some news that we put out there. That really makes me feel great.
What do you think that is?
Here's the thing. I mean, having a yield on an asset is insanely valuable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you take my Stone IPA and it pays a 3% yield versus Renee's Stone IPA that pays nothing, my Stone IPA is way more valuable than Renee's.
Right.
I'll take the one with the yield, thank you.
And it's
looks like you need another one.
Yeah, well, you've got yourself one, but you didn't get me one. I was a bit surprised about that.
Oh, you're in my home. Get whatever you need.
Oh, thank you. Right?
What was I going to jump into? So, basically, to produce the yield that you guys have with this interest-bearing account, the people lending the Bitcoin on the other side need to be a profitable endeavor. So I think... Going back to like the five
counterparty risk framework.
Yeah, the five buckets of sort of counterparties that you're looking for and risk models for that.
So there's five right now. We're primarily operating in the top two, and we're doing a little bit in the third. So the first one I mentioned already was CME and SIBO. Second one is traditional financial institutions who have large businesses in public equities or other traditional markets, but are now starting to get active in crypto. And the ones we're lending to the most are market makers and proprietary trading firms.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things that happens that I think is important to note is that when you have a relationship with a firm like that, you are under very strict non-disclosure agreements about saying that you lend them anything. Or that you can't. You're not allowed to disclose specifically who it is. But one of the things we've been saying when we get this question is, you know, look at who invested in our last round at BlockFi to get an idea of the types of people we might be lending to.
Mm-hmm.
Fidelity, Susquehanna, Acuna Capital, CMT Digital, and others. The third group, so that's the second group, traditional FIs. Those two we prioritized the most. And the vast majority of the lending activity that we've done to date has been in those two buckets. Third bucket we're active in a little bit, which is the crypto business bucket.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a few different sub-segments of the crypto business bucket. There's long-short crypto funds, so like crypto only. There's crypto OTC desks, so your Genesis, Circle, Cumberland, all those guys. And then there's crypto ATM businesses, or kind of crypto corporates, right? So it could be an ATM. It could even be Jack with the Cash App. They mm-hmm. have to have the Bitcoin available to deliver the second somebody clicks buy on the Cash App. So they might borrow that at some point in time rather than just hold the balance sheet risk of the price volatility. Fourth bucket is more traditional corporates, which actually Jack's would be in the fourth bucket, not the third, but more traditional corporates. So in the U.S. you have Square. In Japan you have Rakuten. Anyone that's a traditional company, not just a crypto company, who might want to borrow because they're in the purchase and selling flow with crypto. And then the fifth bucket is DeFi. And we're not active in buckets four or five at all yet.
Your biggest competitor.
What's that?
Your biggest competitor, DeFi.
That's DeFi. We don't think of them as competitive. I mean, look. I think, as a general market, we're kind of like pre... No, I just feel like it's still so early, man, for the addressable market of this stuff, and we don't think of them as competitor. We think that we could leverage those platforms to help our business and vice versa, and yeah,
like how banks leverage Prosper and Lending Club.
Second.
Well, no, I think it goes to say the fifth bucket, you're a little apprehensive. And how much of...
Not apprehensive, it's just not that big yet.
Yeah, well, exactly. So how much of the nations of, like, this technology and this space in particular, like, do you take in consideration, like, does that keep you up at night? Like, holy shit, it's so early. Like, are we too early? Are we going to get caught in something? Because
I mean, we jumped into the pool, so you can't worry about that much. It's too late. It's already pocketed. We've raised $60 million and we're doing this, and there's people who expect us to do this, so you can't just like wake up one morning and be like, I think we're a little too early, we're getting out.
No, I'm not saying you're gonna think about getting out. I'm saying, like, what keeps you up at night, like, thinking about
this? I'll tell you what keeps me up at night right now. It's less business stuff. Like, honestly, it's trying to find a balance between, like, working with personally and with the team, working all the time and having a good quality of life. That's what keeps me up at night, like, literally right now. So prior to launching this product, there was a period of a month where it was just nonstop work. And then we launched it, and we had, like, thousands of people on the first day signing up and getting through. We've never had that before in the company's history. Everyone, like, it was controlled, but it was like controlled insanity. Like, it'd be radio silent in the office, and everyone was just like, I mean, it was crazy. We're working a ton. And
it's like you turn a dial. It's like, oh, people like this.
And that's good. And it's very, very exciting. But, you know, everybody's got their tolerance before they hit burnout. And we have really great people on the team. And I also, like, you know, there's parts where, like, this is my company. And, like, that person didn't sleep last night. Or, like, that guy's got the flu. And he was, like, coding at 3 a.m. because we, like, needed to get this product out. And so how do we resource the company properly so that throughout our next stages of growth, when we're releasing the next products, there's maybe not as much of a pressure-filled situation. But that's what keeps me up at night now. I'm not worried about the market. I feel actually great about the market.
I do too.
The fact that we're still alive, the fact that BlockFi is just part of a theme of lots of companies and people who are still here, still building good stuff, smart stuff, stuff that helps the market. That doesn't worry me at all.
Yeah,
I haven't sold since the last time I was here. I haven't sold a single thing. I actually bought some more because I try stuff all the time. I'm like, oh, new thing over here. Like, I'll buy some through that.
You know, personally, I guess it's a good time to throw a disclaimer. BlockFi has been a sponsor of this podcast in the past, but, you know, I've been stacking sats.
Stacking sats like crazy, man.
Via the ad sales, you know. That's how I've been stacking sats recently. But one thing I'm fascinated, like, outside of product stuff, but, like, growing a company in particular as CEO, like, how much do you weigh, like, spreading yourself too thin versus, like, by hiring too much people versus, like, keeping it, like, a core, let's grow slow and steady, like, with people that you fucking want to build this out? Like, how do you weigh that?
Something that I read a while back that resonated with me a lot was that if you're the CEO of a startup, or even if you're just one of the first people at a startup or a leader at a startup, you actually have to be good at operating like four different types of companies.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning, you have to be really good at operating the, you know, 10 people or less startup, where it's just like, hey, every day we can decide something, and then, like, by the end of the day, it's done. Like, we just did that. Oh, cool, great, boom. Everybody knows what's going on. And then you get to, like, the 10 to 50 or 10 to 75 people stage, where somewhere as you're going through that, you're like, whoa, 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 guys. We need to have ways that we communicate things with everyone. Like, just saying it now in a certain meeting doesn't work anymore, because then, you know, Sally, Steve, and John were on vacation that week, and then they come back and they have no idea what's going on. And so you've got to learn how to have communication that's scalable. That's also the stage where you need to start building a culture, and talking about that culture, because, you know, person number 60 shows up, and if on day two you haven't told him kind of like the vibe we're going for here, he might do some weird stuff, and, you know, that's no fun for anybody. And then you got, like, the 75 to 250 people stage, where all of those things kind of just get exacerbated.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the 250 plus stage, which actually I'm not familiar with.
Yeah.
I don't even know what that stage looks like. I've read about it. But I've always kind of been, like, a high growth startup guy. So, the companies I've worked at have always been bought before we've been 250 people, so I don't know.
I've been a small company guy myself.
Yeah.
I can't imagine working for a company like bigger than 250.
I worked at Google for a month and I quit. through an acquisition.
No, that's one thing that fascinates me.
I've been in a big company.
Yeah.
Yeah, how is it? Can I tell an intro story for Renee?
Oh, yeah.
To talk about working at a big bank. So I knew Renee while he was still at Bank of America, Maryland. Mm-hmm. And then I knew him after he left and started working at BlockFi full time. It was night and day. He used to come in, like, when he was advising us, like, in a suit, you know, scowl on his face, like, super smart, nice guy, but, like, scowling, kind of. And then afterwards, he's, like, dressing cool, smiling, his shoulders are, like, 2 inches shorter, you know.
Oh, you're looking like you just hopped out of Flatiron right now.
So what's working at a huge company like?
So, there was actually a time it was actually a lot of fun, okay, to be honest. But and that's what worries me a lot about crypto as well, is that when the regulators get around to it to sort of say, okay, let me tell you how to do things, it becomes a lot less fun.
Yeah.
You know. And I as Zach knows, I have a lot of problem with authority.
I do as well.
Boss. No. It's like a little bit like, you know, I mean, I know what's good, right? I mean, we can talk about it, but you don't need to tell me what's good and what to do. And, mm-hmm. and I find that the regulators tend to sort of go down that path, right? So, yes, I do think, I agree with, you know, of course regulations need to sort of adopt crypto, and we sort of need what we have already, make sure that crypto is incorporated, because crypto is not addressed, like, in many ways. But I don't think we need, like, special new ones, right? We have plenty of it as well. It definitely does something, regulation, right?
So how did things change at the bank between?
Yeah, so before.
How were the Louis Ranieri days?
Yeah, so before the financial crisis, it was there was a lot more. I would say it was not as hierarchical. And it was a lot more like, you know, okay, let's do things. Let's talk about it. Let's get to the right people. You would, you know, you have the credit department, you have the business side. I was at the business side. Business side wanted to do something. We talked to credit. We would go to our bosses. We would all go up together. And if it needed to be, the CEO would get involved if it was an idea we wanted to do. That changed after 08. You know, how it changes a little bit, you should think about it. If the regulators find a problem in a business that's like, you know, far below, right? So it's like 7 levels from the CEO. They find problems there. They actually type up a letter to the board of directors. And the board of directors can't, what the fuck, right? So they're not going to go to the business owner, that's 7 levels below, they go to the CEO, right? And then the CEO says, oh, shit. Okay, let me get Tommy come in because I don't know much about this, right? So everybody's sort of on the back foot, and it gets worse as it comes down. And that creates sort of a culture where decisions are just completely centralized.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And, you know, I'm becoming DeFi or you know, it's the decentralize or die, right? Kind of thing. It is like, it's completely the opposite that you want, right? And it kills innovation, and it kills morale as well, and people become like a little bit like, you know, I got you kind of culture. Let's see how I can demonstrate how you tripped up, what you did wrong, instead of actually, hey, let me help you and let me make it work.
So different. I've got two
very political too, by the way.
I know. I'm very anti-authority. I have like a physical aversion to authority. When somebody tells me what to do, I like shrivel up and like stop.
You got married though.
I love my wife as well. I did get married. I'm not authority.
That's true, married. All right, you work for the boss.
That's a partnership, okay?
Partnership,
Renee. Yeah. Well, I've got two follow-up questions. Yeah. One, so the regulators came down, obviously, because you got way too over-levered going up to 08, and a lot of people would argue way too over-financialized. Like, so essentially, 08 was a run-on. Mm-hmm.
I think we should talk about what we thought caused 08.
All right. Let me get my question out. And let's
all right.
So, regulators came down because people would argue we're over-levered, too financialized, with too much intertwining leverage. in particular, specifically with CDMs, or excuse me, CMS.
CDS, credit default
swaps. Yeah, credit default swaps, which were basically insurance policies on
securitization.
So collateralized
MBSs,
excuse me.
Defaults.
Mortgage-backed securities. The CDSs were the insurance policies on the MBSs. So people think that got out of hand, and that's why the regulation sort of came down with the hammer. You guys seems like think something else was the cause. And then number two, in Bitcoin, so the episode I dropped today with Jake Stravinsky, we talk a lot about regulation and how you sort of foster light touch and how do we engage regulators? Should we engage them? Should we try to get ahead of the problem and say, hey, this is what we're doing? And how do you face this? Like, I would love no regulation, but obviously
that's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. So how do you get ahead of it? So let's start with 08.
There are probably many things that caused it, right? But one of the things is sort of like, so what was the immediate solution after 08, right? So the immediate solution was, let's turn all the big broker-dealers into banks.
Yeah.
Right? So what does a bank have that nobody else has? Well, the bank can call the Federal Reserve and say, hey, give me more money, right? So let's print some more money, basically. Mm-hmm. And that was just needed. So in my mind, it was mostly a liquidity issue that maybe turned a little bit into a capital issue as well, right? So people didn't, there was not enough equity to support the business, not enough risk out to support the business. But it for sure started with liquidity, and it that's what sort of said, okay, certain banks had no capital left, like say Merrill Lynch, so let you go and be part of Bank of America now. And others, they were told, you're now a bank. The banks are obviously like, you know, they have a really special status, right? So, as you know, they create money. Mm-hmm. That we people in Bitcoin probably don't like as much, right? And we don't think it's a good
thing. Bitcoiners are not fans of the Quintilian effect.
It's a way of organizing, right? So it went exactly the opposite, and that's probably also why there is something like Bitcoin, right? It went completely central. Right, every decision is made by the Federal Reserve then, right? And the OCC, they determine what's going to go and what's not going to go, right? They're going to say, I don't like this business, you're out of it. And you say as a bank, said, well, I like it. Well, guess what? You're no longer taking deposits in the United States. Oh, wait a minute. You know what? I'm not going to do this anymore, right? They did everything to make it central clearing. So you can say, like, okay, well, at least now we have one counterparty, and the counterparty is great. Like, say, you know, they made it so that your capital requirements, if you face the CME or any central clearing firm, that you have a lot less capital that you need, right? So that forces people to go into the business. And if you don't do that, that's okay too. We're going to set universal margin rules as well. So we're going to say you are like as you're facing exchange. So you might not like the fact that now you have to put up 20% margin and can be, or sorry, say 20% margin can only be 5 times leverage. You want to be 10 times levered. You cannot do that just amongst each other. We kind of set rules around that as well, right? But it's completely the opposite that in the end people want, because people keep talking now as well, like, hey, the billions of banks are too big and want to break them up. You got all this centralized risk. Well, actually, that's what the rules did, right? The rules force you to go in that direction.
No, you had that famous chart of bank consolidation over the last 3 decades. And
yeah, so not a lot of community banks left.
Right?
That's BlockFi, you know. Maybe won't answer that, but yeah, it's not what you want, I think, right?
But do the JP Morgans, the Bank of America's, Chase, or who are the other big four? Wachovia,
Wells Fargo.
Wells Fargo.
Wells
Fargo bought Wachovia. Yeah. I'm from Philly, so
City
it's like the Philly. So do those big banks, do they want that consolidation? Are they happy about it? And if so, like.
Well, think about it. I think Wells Fargo.
Do they have feelings?
Bad feelings towards Bitcoin. I know that.
Well, you do they want it, right? So it's like, I think at the sort of management level, probably makes a lot easier if you're one of the four, right, instead of one of the 4D, because you got to actually compete for stuff. If you're a banker that gets paid in, on the amount of deals you do, you probably be having much more decentralized. And you go back like, look, guys, I'd rather have a whole bunch of smaller broker dealers and I get a decent compensation, right? Or an outrageous compensation, depends on what you think you're worth, right? Mm-hmm. Or people think you're worth. I mean, you know, Wells got to a place that they had 10% of all the deposits in the United States, and they were not allowed to acquire any more banks. Right? It was that big, and they're still that big.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's got more centralized, right? And I think people that listen to your podcast will probably think that it will agree that it should be a lot more decentralized in the middle, right?
Yeah, well, that's what scares the shit out of me. I think that's why a lot of people who listen to this podcast are into Bitcoin. And that's why I'm into Bitcoin in particular, because I worked in the finance world. My job in particular was to follow the Fed, and I realized how much influence the Fed had over the markets and what everybody did. And I was like, this is just fucked. Like, and
did you follow the narrow bank story at all, TNB?
It's
pretty interesting. It came up recently. So there was
this, ringing a bell.
Yeah, so there were these guys. I read this this daily newsletter called Money Stuff from Matt Levine. I haven't read it in like 3 weeks, and it pains me to say that because I love this newsletter so much.
I follow him on Twitter, so I'll see it fly down my tweet deck every once in a while.
So he was talking about the narrow bank, okay? And basically the idea for the narrow bank was, we're going to create a bank that just does one thing. We're just going to give people access to the Federal Reserve.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. There's a letter.
Then we're going to have one product. So, like, if you hold your deposits with the narrow bank, it's just, they're at the Fed. Like, that's it. That's all we do. That's all we do. And they got declined. The Fed said you can't do it.
Because they're not taking on enough risk?
And this is a recent thing, yeah, because they said, we think that if you do that, if we approve this, you're going to be a big vacuum, and all the deposits are going to come to you, because why would anybody who's depositing want to deposit anywhere else if they could just actually get a risk-free deposit by having you as their counterparty?
And make 2%.
You are basically the Federal Reserve.
And make 2% instead of the 50 bips you get.
50 bips, yeah, exactly.
So they declined it, and their argument was centered around all these, was centered around, you know, the broader economy. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, if we let this happen, it's going to be a net negative for economic activity. And it's a valid argument. So you get into these kind of like catch-22 situations where, you know, too big to fail. Or in BlockFi's case, not to bring it back to BlockFi, but like you have lawyers and try to do the right thing and disclose everything, and then you're called out on Twitter for saying
you had two questions. What was the other one again? Sorry,
you have a follow-up question.
This follow-up question was about regulation in Bitcoin. Like, it's pretty raw right now.
So obviously,
do we need to hold their hands?
Have the fair minimum. Right? Yeah. So what's the minimum get away with? So the interesting thing about Bitcoin, obviously, I think, is also it's a global thing, right? So if you regulate a lot of stuff in the U.S., then why people don't do it somewhere else, right? I think you want to keep it to a minimum. And you can sort of regulate in the U.S. People going from Bitcoin into dollars, right? So to regulate the fiat aspect of it, right?
Well, let's pull the anarchist out of you. Like, can you regulate this?
No.
Can you? Like,
how can you?
Right?
How can you? Right.
And is there a point at which the authorities recognize this and throw their hands up and say, what the fuck? Like,
but that's not in the nature of people that are called regulators, right? So regulators, they like to
how do we get rid of them? How do we get rid of them?
God, man, I wish I could. You know, like, so there are a couple of buttons you can push on here. This is probably one of them. But so I'm also a firm believer. If we get to this down this path, like it's like, right? I mean, the United States was founded, right? As we all know, with the Boston Tea Party. And mm-hmm. said, you know, no taxation without representation. I also believe in the opposite, right? So, you know, like the government does whatever with the money you pay them, but I don't see much in return, if I could like say.
Not only do you see much in return, but you give them their money, you give them your money, and they turn around and piss in your face by completely spending it completely inefficiently. Like a story.
Right. So if you pay tax and you can say what happens to it. Like, even if it was like 10%, they say 10%, I can say what happens to it. I feel so much better about paying taxes.
Right.
It's
a note out there. I think that's the fifth time I said right on this podcast. I've been trying to stop saying right. It's a sort of tick of mine that I fall back on. I'm going to try to stop saying right on the podcast, freaks. But
going back to taxation, that is something when I was like 22 working at the Managed Futures Fund, like that was one thing I worked on my spare time, was figuring out a way to prove like where your tax dollars is going, or like how can you
create something. Did you find out what happened, or did you figure it out, or?
No. Nobody ever will. The one story in particular that we talked about in this podcast a couple weeks ago was, there was an example that came out of, so the U.S. government, particularly the military, contracts a lot of work out to third parties, and when it comes to acquiring face cream, moisturizer, for people risking their lives overseas for the U.S. government, not the U.S. government, the American people, the U.S. government was spending $14,000 on $30 tubes of face cream. And they spent, I think they racked up $65
million. But sunscreen, I hope.
Even so, they're paying 450x, like the price, and it's something. There's no accountability with tax. Yeah, so just there's tax accountability.
Yeah, to come back to your regulation, right? So you can regulate everything and say, okay, this is what's good, this is what's bad, and then the argument, what's good, what's bad, right? So instead of saying, okay, let's do the bare minimum, right? So, you know, you start, obviously, with you can't really commit fraud, right? So that's bad, and it's pretty sort of relatively easy to identify what fraud is. But do you need to regulate, like one of the things that's regulated in equity markets is things like, you know, best bid and offers, and you got to actually get the best price. You got to give the retail guy the best price possible. But in crypto, that's not possible directly, because these exchanges or marketplaces are not really exchanges from a regulatory perspective, right? They're not connected. So, you know, you're trading Kraken, you get a different price than trading at the same millisecond at Coinbase, right? Whereas in equity markets, it doesn't happen.
Let's talk about that. That's one thing that Jack Mallers and I talked a lot about. Jack Mallers from the Zap Wallet, bright young kid out of Chicago. Shout out Jack. But he comes from a family of CBOT royalty in particular, so he knows the Chicago Board of Trade and futures markets very innately, and the trading infrastructure that goes into linking up CME CBOT with traders in New York and across the world. And that was one thing he pointed out, is like, it's atrocious like how Bitcoin exchanges are run and interconnected at this point. And so, like, what are the biggest...
Or not connected, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. Fragmented.
Yes, fragmented. And
yeah, is that a bad thing? I mean, what's the alternative?
What needs to happen? So what is the problem? What needs to happen?
All right, so let's get all the governments together in the world that where crypto trades, like including Russia and China, wherever it is, and Korea, and let's all get into a room and come up with some uniform regulations. What are the chances of that, right? I mean...
Zero,
right? We cannot even agree on if there's global warming or not with all of us, right? And figure that out. So, let alone crypto.
All right, let's jump into that.
There we go. Now we're talking.
But, look, I mean, there's no way they can agree. So why just don't immediately say, look, we're not going to agree on this. So just not do anything, right? Just say, okay, fine, there will be multiple prices of Bitcoin at any given time. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. That probably is okay. And how will it solve? How is Bitcoin not 5,000 on Coinbase and at the same time 3,500 on Gemini? Well, that's because you got people that say, hey, there's an arbitrage, let me fix that. I'm going to sell it at 5,000 at Kraken and buy the 3,500 at Gemini, and the prices will get closer. Right? And that clearly what's happening, or something like that is happening, because the prices are pretty close.
Yeah, they're still.
And that's a good point. So in order to do that, some of these venues, and especially if you want to access them quickly, you need Bitcoin. And so one of the bigger use case that we've seen for us lending Bitcoin so far versus using it to short is using it because you're providing that service to the market that Renee just described.
For the arbors.
And you need Bitcoin to do it.
Yeah.
And you've got a CFO at your proprietary trading firm who goes, oh yeah, it looks like a great opportunity. It's selling for 5,000 over here and 3,500 over there. We should take advantage of that. How much money do we need to do that? And it's like, the traders are like, we need 100 million. And then he's like, great, approved. And then they're like, we need 100 million in Bitcoin. And he's like, what? And they're like, yeah, because if we do it in dollars, like, we can't even trade on this one, and we, well, and so then the CFO goes, well, can we just like borrow some Bitcoin and lock in a fixed cost of, you know, what that expense is going to be, rather than start our market making activities with a net long exposure to Bitcoin, because you know, I'm 60 years old and I don't believe in this stuff. I don't even know what you're talking about. I
have no idea what this is.
And they go, yeah, sure, we could borrow it. And then BlockFi's on that other side lending it to them.
Mm-hmm. That's how, for example, the price of ETF stays in line with the underlying, right?
Yes.
That simply because people are arbitraging that and creating and redeeming them at the right price.
No, this is something that has interested me for a while, because I've heard second, third hand of people creating accounts in multiple countries.
And they make money on that.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. That's probably
they get paid for the service.
They get paid for the service, right? You can also say, all right, let's get some regulators in the room, and they're going to make sure that it's all correct, and we're going to pay those guys. So my money is rather on the, you know, people that are motivated by economics to get this done than the guys that are pencil pushers.
And that's actually another another fascinating thing about Bitcoin, though. It has found very smart people have found out ways to exploit these arbitrage opportunities and stuff like
that's
that.
That's perfect, right? That's you and I want that, right? I mean, I want one price of Bitcoin, or at least, you know, it's close enough, right?
So what do you think about things like the Trade Block Index or Cumberland's Guide to Indexes?
It's great, no?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. It's great.
Well, so... And you guys are using Gemini. So is all of your price index off Gemini's price at any given time?
No, we use an index.
Which one?
I can't say.
Can't say. Okay.
Could say, but would rather not.
No, because people could look at that index and try to manipulate.
It's less about that, and it's more just like, I think there's a handful of good index providers, and I don't want to say which one we used first and have that influence anything.
Ooh. Clout flexing on the pot tonight.
Here we go.
Okay,
now.
We're an hour and 20 in. What, outside of BlockFi, like in Bitcoin, what's exciting you the most, in Bitcoin in particular? Like you said, you're as bullish as ever. I'm as well. I think fundamentals are fucking incredible from a technology perspective, and then from a macro perspective. Let's talk macro. Macro is scaring the hell out of me right now. The themes around the world.
So, talking macro. So, in my mind, there's a couple things that drive macro. There's basically demographics, and then how well is your currency measured. Demographics, I'm bullish on China, despite how, you know, authoritarian their regime is. How is your currency measured? I'm bullish on the dollar. Combine those. I'm in general bullish on currency consolidation as a theme that happens. I think that one of the things that the internet did was it, you know, you could say that it had a large level of influence in toppling a few dictators, because there were people who could message each other on Facebook and gather up at the same place at the same time and, you know, tell the dictator to go fuck himself. I think cryptocurrency will enable that same type of revolution in certain places in the next, you know, I don't know, 2 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that currency consolidation will be a theme. I don't think that we need to have however many currencies we have. I think it's like way too many. I think there could be 5 or 10 or maybe 20 at the most, but like we just don't need that many. We're interconnected now. Like let's consolidate. And I hope that Bitcoin is one of those that gets consolidated into.
I do as well. And one thing out of Deutsche Bank, I believe, they presented this a few weeks ago at most, that I found fascinating, was there's more $100 bills in circulation now than $1 bills, and mostly being bought by foreigners.
Dude, the dollar is a beast.
Yeah, the demand for the dollar is higher now. When I saw that stat that there's more $100 bills than $1 bills in circulation... I was like, what the fuck? I would have never guessed that. So that shows.
Dollar's
and then.
Beast.
Beast. I know. We discussed this the first time we were on.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's getting precarious, though, still. Like, we're a few years away from our tax receipts being less than the interest owed on the debt that we've accrued.
Yeah, you know, it doesn't matter. Right?
Here's the thing, it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
what do you mean?
I hate that argument.
Yeah, people say that.
People say never, like, never say never. Like,
magic money theory.
stuff stuff does come to fruition, and the roosters do come, or the hens do come home to roost. Like,
yeah,
this stuff cannot happen forever. I don't know. That's
yeah, but can it keep happening for the next 100 years, 200 years?
I don't know. Maybe 100, 200 years? I don't know.
But here's what I struggle with. I'll tell you what I struggle with the demise of the dollar thought. What takes its place?
Bitcoin.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
And I'm not saying right now.
The reality.
I don't think it's 100 or 200 years.
The reality.
What if there's a power outage?
Like an EMP attack? Then we got bigger problems.
No, we had a power outage in New York City too. It's not that long ago. I mean, I don't remember it. I'm not sure when it was, but it was like.
Well, hopefully.
Sandy, right?
I was sleeping
in my winter coat or something. I remember that, yeah.
Well, hopefully by the time. Again, I don't think Bitcoin's going to take over the dollar like in the next decade or two decades, maybe three decades, but hopefully by the time that has come. Mesh networks and satellite networks and radio short-term radio wave networks have been worked out, and you don't need electricity. You can send it via radio wave.
I'll tell you what we can do, Renee.
Okay.
Print paper bitcoins.
You can do that as well.
Yeah. Why not? Somebody's got to do that, right?
I've got an open dime right here.
Things come full circle.
Yeah.
Things come full circle. I mean, Amazon's got physical stores.
Yeah. So, Renee. Renee, how do you see Bitcoin? Like, do you ever see it becoming a reserve currency, or do you see it playing a niche like gold in the future?
No. I really like the payment rails. That's fucking awesome, right? Mm-hmm. But could I see, like, you know, I actually think that currency could be like a lot more local too, right? So you can say something like, you know, I like decentralization a lot, I guess. You know, like, you know, when you go get a beer at the bar, you know, you can pay in a couple of dollars. You don't really need Bitcoin for that kind of stuff, right? But, you know, I can imagine also that if you're, you know, the Chinese or Russian government, you just must hate the fact that oil is denominated in dollars and not in something else, right? So some of these things will probably start a bit outside of the U.S. Our systems here, in Western Europe in general, in the Western countries in general, it works pretty well, like... You can buy things, the credit systems work, you can borrow stuff, other places it won't work. And then probably there first you say, well, look, you know, Bitcoin is a very good alternative to many other currencies, maybe not towards the dollar yet, but, you know, could it like take over the dollar? Sure, you know, at some point.
I like when the anarchist comes out of Renee. Yeah. I know it's in there. I can see the aversion for authority you have. I can see it in somebody's face as somebody who has it themselves. You know.
Yeah, I do have a hard time with
We're pushing an hour and a half here. It's been fun, guys.
Felt like 20 minutes.
Right?
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to think. So are you guys going to steal all the Bitcoin? I guess that's the one question.
Steal?
Are you guys going to steal all the Bitcoin? That's the one question I have to ask.
No, I mean, I'll say right now. So there's, I don't think we've said either one of these things before. The money in the interest accounts is the most senior part of our capital stack, and you probably know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
We will, and also any money from BlockFi employees, and I think I was account number one, and I think Renee was account number like, four, maybe, or something, in the interest account. Anybody else's money is also senior to any BlockFi employee money that's in the accounts. I view BlockFi's worst-case scenario as being, we don't raise the next round of venture capital, we go bankrupt, and everybody gets their money back. And that sucks for us, because we're heavily invested in BlockFi equity with our time and salary reductions. It's impossible for me to see a scenario where we have lost people's money in the interest account.
I that's what I said on Rapid Hole Recap last week. I find it hard. Like, you guys are very well capitalized, and I you freaks out there. I've sat down with Zach many times. I trust you as a businessman, and but it is interesting to see once you announce these products, like crypto, Twitter, especially the hardcore Bitcoiners react. But again, like, these products, if you don't want to use them, don't use them. And if you, like, There are.
It's not the beauty, you have a choice.
Right?
I'm sorry.
If the market wants more choices, it's there.
I put out a tweet the other day, and it said, it was like, prediction. In 2019, Bitcoin, I think Bitcoin in 2019 is going to be up for the year between, somewhere between like 25 and 200%.
Boss.
And...
That's
and
it.
I actually believe that we're in a different era now, where because there's so many instruments available, you're not going to see a. I don't think we're going to see a, like, you know, we're up 10x this year. Like, I just think that's, those days might be behind us, and that's okay. I still think it's a phenomenal investment. I think it's going to be up a lot. I think the risk adjusted return beats, you know, most of anything else that's in my portfolio. So we're going to be in, you know, January 2nd, January 3rd, January 4th, 2020, and all the financial publications are going to be writing about the performance of assets in 2019, and Bitcoin's going to look really great. And then new people are going to come in and buy Bitcoin because of that. Some of them for the first time. And what do we want? And maybe they follow some Bitcoin people on crypto Twitter. And what do we want those, like, brand new users who have never owned it before to arrive to? We want them, and the question, I did a little poll. I was like, what do we want those new users to arrive to? And there are three options. And the first one was a diversity of good options. The second one was ICO shields. And the third one was not your keys, not your Bitcoin only.
Right?
And the results were like 68% or 70% a diversity of good options. 7% of people voted ICO shields. And like 30% was not your keys only. I just don't think it has to be an either or, right? You don't have to pick one or the other. Like, clearly, it's better.
I don't either.
Yeah, like, I mean, if you know someone who's 60 years old,
send it, bruh.
I mean, can you imagine explaining to your parents how to use a Trezor? And maybe you could. I can't.
Do you think it's going to work in 10 years? By the way, thought about that.
Oh, that's an interesting
one. My computer from 10 years ago, I can't get it to run anymore. I still got shit on it that I never took off because I was too lazy.
I mean, the hardware wallet, I'm not going to pick on Trezor in particular, hardware.
No, hardware wallet.
Hardware wallets in particular, I mean, they are very specific. I'm not sure, but obviously...
The paper wallet will work.
Paper wallet will work. Yeah, I mean, ideally...
Just make sure it doesn't burn somewhere or whatever. Or,
yeah, ideally you have, like, you have it, like, embedded into, like, a piece of gold or something that's in... Like a gun lockbox, as Pierre Richard
did
would say.
Did you see Lop in the New York Times?
Yeah. Shout out Jameson.
Dude,
did you see that?
Getting
did
into the mainstream.
I don't like the newspapers anymore, sorry.
Neither do I.
There's no need.
Just Coindesk and Block and crypto Twitter, that's it?
Yeah. Jameson...
once a week an overview or something from The Economist, that's enough.
Yeah, Jameson.
Changing every day, man. What the fuck?
I haven't read the article. I only saw tweets about it. So apparently, Jameson got interviewed by the New York Times saying how he like went completely off the grid after being swatted. Yeah, it's a real threat.
Talk about paper, you know, and Sandy, you know, where Boney kept their certificates.
Where?
On Water Street. In New York. You know why it's called Water Street, probably too.
Because the water probably.
Yeah, so they got it back, our documents, pretty water damaged, and had to go to the issuers and get it. You know, get
new ones.
Well, that's actually. I hope.
Right?
Yeah, but I hope there's unique ways. So I actually thought of a, or down. I didn't think of. I was introduced to an analog, a manual way to store your private keys. Where you basically have an off-network multi-sig setup. I really hope I can get this guy on the podcast to come explain it. But you basically have a number system that you associate with words in a dictionary, and you just keep those numbers like on a piece of steel or a piece of paper, whatever, in many places, and you know a special edition of a specific dictionary that you go find and you match up.
It's fun to be in your own bank, right?
Right?
It's fun to be in your
own bank. And match up your own words.
We got 100 random people in a room at a cocktail party. How many of them do you think are capable of doing that?
Right? Not many. But that's the other thing.
Or willing, too, right?
Yeah.
Or willing, yeah.
But again, it's... I would argue it's worthwhile if you take full control of it. At least some of it. But again, going back to like
I think there will be times, right? So certain times you have full control.
Exactly. Like if you're fucking escaping China or some North Korea or whatever it may be, and you want to fucking run around the world naked so nobody like strip searches you for your treasure or whatever.
Yeah, if you live in New York and lost your apartment keys 2 months ago and feel incredible anxiety when you have responsibility over the security of anything, you have to remember all those steps that you just described. That's okay. It's okay.
One of my favorite Nuraj Bitcoin tweets was, I think it was after Zappo came out and announced like their vault services like in the middle of the Alps Swiss or something like that. Yeah. He's like,
yeah, really great.
So it was like a meme of not Nelson, one of the other Simpsons characters. Lisa, the guy is Ralph. It was Ralph, like, I have existential fear. He's like, yeah, this is how I feel, knowing that some people have their Bitcoin in a vault in the Alps and mine's on a post-it note in my underwear drawer. it's something I have to overcome. And that's actually why I'm excited to see like more multi-sig solutions come out, too, because I think that helps the problem as well. And so, like, forcing that, the UX around multi-sig in particular is something I'm fascinated with right now as well.
Shout out to the guys at Unchained.
Yeah, shout out to Unchained.
Drew,
Joe Kelly, and team announcing the vault. You guys have multi-sig in the future?
No, we don't custody anything. We think custody should be free, and we should not do it.
Yeah. It's interesting. That's the other thing. Like you said, it's so early, and it's so interesting seeing everybody attack a piece of the pie in different ways, and I think
that's what we want.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I'm, like you said, and we've been hinting, not even hinting, overtly saying throughout the podcast, like, I'm more optimistic than I've ever been. I mean, unless there's an EMP attack, a solar, there's a solar flare, yes, we could be wary.
It's starting to feel good.
Yeah, but believe it or not, we're getting closer to, like, not having to worry about a solar flare, which is actually crazy to think about.
How so?
Yeah.
What is that?
Like, the hypothetical is, like, a solar flare EMP attack wipes out the electricity. How do you propagate Bitcoin transactions? Technically, you'd use like radio waves or mesh networks. Hopefully, people are saving some stuff in Faraday cages so they can use their antennas.
At least someone needs to keep the blockchain somewhere, right?
Well, it's being backed up on this computer every 10 minutes or every block. Yeah. So.
Okay. Yeah. At least it'll go to you.
Yeah. Or somebody around the world who wasn't affected by the EMT. That's what Ralph Merkel. I think he said it best. Like, Bitcoin will survive like a nuclear apocalypse. It's like a cockroach that will never die that keeps replicating itself in geographically dispersed areas. And
yeah.
If like a nuclear apocalypse came, it'd be like the rats, the cockroaches, and Bitcoin that would like survive.
All right.
Good. I gotta buy some more Bitcoin.
I guess it's a good place to end. You guys got any parting notes for the freaks?
Stay freaky.
Stay freaky. That's what we try to do here. Renee, welcome to the Thunderdome, dude.
Welcome. Yeah, it's my debut.
I can't wait to bring the anarchist in you out a little bit more the next time I speak.
Next time, just Renee.
Yeah. We'll make it happen. Gentlemen, thank you for coming by the apartment.
Thanks for having us, man.
Thanks.
It's been a pleasure. Peace and love, freaks.
Boom.
It was fun.
It was good, right?
Yeah. It flew by. Like you said,
it was two hours. Dude, I thought it was 20 minutes.
It said, was 2 people, 2 hours? Is that what you're thinking?
I just let it go. Once it hits late hour 20, I'm like...
So when's the woman coming home?
I don't know. She might have texted me. Her show probably started right now, so not for a while.
So when are you going to put this out? I just want you to give us a heads up so we can retweet it and pump it.
I was thinking Thursday.
Oh, nice. That's
awesome. Yeah. I could turn around. Or Friday. Friday's probably the best day to do it.
Yeah.
Friday's the best download day, so I'll do it then.
Just shoot me an email or a DM or like whatever. That way I can tell her out, like,
dude. Oh my god, I forgot to hit record.